Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine, then, and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
You can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Hello, and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode one. Today is November 22nd, 2013. This is a brand new podcast.
I don't want to geek out on you like a comics person, but as somebody that's used to rebooting with a new title, this is actually more like a negative 0.5 episode.
Oh, yeah?
It's just the review, right?
Well, no, it's isn't it more like issue zero, like the event, the thing that you would give away at Free Comic Book Day?
This is the digital comic that's coming out in advance of Old Boy. To help flesh out the character.
But the first installment, right?
Tumblr. This may in fact be episode 0.5, as it is, you're right, it is the review episode. The point being, this is a new podcast. You may recognize all of these voices in this chatter from Operation Kino, which is the podcast that we had for 3 years. We have moved on from Operation Kino headquarters. It is overrun with tumbleweeds now. I believe there are stray dogs living inside it. Sad to see it go, but excited to have a fresh start here at fightinginthewarroom.com. We have lots of other places where you can find us and the show that we'll give you out at the end of the show, because we'll be reviewing Catching Fire, the Hunger Games Catching Fire.
Yeah, Catching Fire by itself means nothing.
Yeah,
yes, no, full no, titles no, only
wait,
on
wait,
this
wait,
podcast.
Wait, here we go. I'm not on the review segment, so here we go. Catching Fire, 0.5 stars. 0.5 stars because at some point you are going to see a picture of me on Facebook fully enveloped in fire. Negative 4.5 stars for horrible third-degree burns over the entirety of my body.
I'm deeply confused as to what just happened.
That is the perfect way to start.
Yes.
So you are actually going to engulf yourself in flames now. Is that
what you're
is a ritual? Oh, what a perfect way
already,
to start.
I've already done it. I'm in the hospital, but I had to review Catching Fire despite having not seen the movie.
Yeah. Well, this is not going to be a tradition where we force Dave to show up at the beginning of our show that has nothing to do with him and in the review. But we wanted everyone here as we start this new adventure of Fighting in the War Room. So we're all here.
I might come back every Friday and review something pointless at the beginning of every episode.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a bad
idea.
We need
Amazon reviews, like Amazon product reviews from you. Just like random objects. And
I have those feelings about products.
I know you do.
Being like Pilot V7 Fine Point Black Liquid Ink Pen.
Ooh.
Now you are by far the best.
Oh, I'm more of a G5 pen guy.
Mm. Now
well,
people
we're
are going
to fight it out.
Now people are going to think that this new show is all about Amazon product reviews. And, you know, if you want that, then stick around. Who knows what else we might review in addition to movies like The Hunger Games Catching Fire. So we'll be back on Monday or Tuesday with a regular length episode. We'll have more of the details of the show worked out by then. But for the most part, same stuff as the old show, same people, and same Dave not seeing the movie most of the time.
Hey, that's none of you invite me. Or when you invite me, it's at 1 p.m. on a Wednesday and I have a job. So I'm not apologizing for that.
Well,
but we're rebooted now. So
like,
all of our dialogue is written by Bob Orsi and Alex Kurtzman.
No, we're entering our In Rainbows post-EMI phase.
We're giving it away for free.
From the shackles of corporate America.
Yeah.
Or in their radio ads case.
We've gone rogue.
Universe.
See, that's awkward because we might start selling advertising now.
Oh, God.
Which I never heard of. That. Well, if we want to start inviting people to pay what they wish for this podcast, I would accept that. So,
I want to only advertise for junk food because junk food is being misrepresented in most media these days.
If you would like to send us random denominations of money, you may pay what you wish.
Yes, we appreciate you regardless of how many quarters you're going to send us in the mail.
The U.S. Postal Service recognizes URLs as addresses now.
What, really?
No, don't send your money to a URL. That was a bad idea.
Oh, my God. All right, Dave, we're going to send you away before you cause any more trouble, but you'll be back for next week's full episode, and you'll probably see Catching Fire eventually, so tell us what you think at that point.
Yeah, I'm going to get a corpse of a mockingbird and the corpse of a blue jay and sew them together by this time next year.
Oh, my God, you're like Hugo, Bart Simpson's evil twin brother who lives in the attic. Never
Not
mind.
Hugo Starts. Cabray.
How many tangents can we take in the opening of this episode?
I know.
This is pure us. This is pure us.
Let's shoot an arrow into the sky and set Dave free from this arena we put him in. Bye, Dave. So Catching Fire, now that Dave's gone, we can talk about it for real, because, you know, there's so much stuff that we have to say about this movie that Dave doesn't want to hear. It's a sequel to The Hunger Games. Patch has famously hated The Hunger Games. David, I feel like you were also not that crazy about The Hunger Games.
I was extremely negative.
I think David was much more negative than I was. I was kind of like, meh, and he was like, ah.
Oh, wow.
So he was more like those CG bear things.
Those are direct sound bites from our Hunger Games episode.
Yeah, that sounds about
which
right.
Which actually, they're not, because we legally don't own those anymore. No, wait, maybe we do. I don't remember.
No, we do.
Oh,
we
okay.
Do.
Woohoo!
So, you remind me, neither of you guys has read the books, or David, have you read the books?
I have never read any book.
I have never read a book. I've read the first Hunger Games book, and then a quarter of the second Hunger Games book, but it was too atrocious, and I threw it away.
Yeah, I have read all of them. I was a fan of them. I mean, I recognize that they are weak in parts, and rereading Catching Fire recently reminds me of that more. But I was excited about this. I fit much more into the, you know, midnight crowd, people dressed with Mockingjay pins on, than either of you two. And unsurprisingly, I really liked this movie. But what surprised me more is seeing it with people who hadn't read the books, who didn't really know anything about it. They were also really into it. It seems like this has gotten markedly better reception than The Hunger Games, which was itself it got pretty good reviews. It was obviously a really big hit.
Although been very interesting to and satisfying in its own way for someone who is not too high on the original to see so many people who loved it or you know said as much when it came out throwing it under the bus in favor of the second one, you know, falling over themselves.
But isn't that everything at this point? It's like whatever is now
it is,
we
but
love.
It feels so recent, you know, exceptionally so in this particular case that I am surprised by the. Degree in which people seem to have realized that they're like, oh, you know, wasn't that good. This one really, I like to think in my own arrogant way that this film helps clarify the, no, not at all. But this film, it's because of Francis Lawrence, which is something, you know, I never thought I'd be attributing him credit of any kind, though I did see and enjoy Water for Elephants, that I think it's helping, the positive attributes of this film are helping clarify the, errors in Gary Ross's film, but also like Christopher Columbus's Harry Potter film, showing that in some regards, if not many or all, he laid a solid foundation in the original for things for sequels to build.
Well, I think that, I mean, and we're getting more in specifics now. We should talk about the movies about, but I think what Gary Ross did, or whoever did it, the smartest thing they ever did was hire Jennifer Lawrence, who carries so much of this movie. I'm starting to wonder if without her, these movies would work at all, because that character in the books is all about this internal dialogue, and she gets really...
I think it's hard to judge that. She's very good in the movies.
Of course.
But...
I mean, you can't be like, all right, recast it with Emma Stone lead role.
Oh, God, it'd be awful.
I mean, I think, of course, you could never say it wouldn't work with anybody else, but I do think that it is a credit to Jennifer Lawrence's performance that these movies do successfully build around her and her performance, because the character is so marginal. I mean, there's so little flavor to her. Like, I think you see as a recurring trend in all of these YA series, the protagonist is always so neutral to the point where – and so such an open vessel to experience that they have actually no personality besides like a basic stoicism. You see it with the girl from Twilight. You see it with Harry Potter. The world happens around them, and they're just sort of a lens, a prism for all of these actions to go through, and we follow them as they get a little bit more brave and take a stand. And
it's interesting, you know, that you say that, because I feel like Katniss does suffer from that a little bit, and Jennifer Lawrence really fights her on that. But we might be getting ahead of ourselves here, Katie. If you wanted to talk about what this movie is about.
Oh, sure. I mean, this movie is about a lot of things. It's fairly long. It's complicated. But basically,
it's not about that many things. There's really not much going on.
Well, all right. I've been
it's
rereading
the
book.
It's the same as the first movie, almost every way, except for the stakes and the little details. But the structure is identical.
Well, the structure is identical, except for at the beginning, you see Katniss and Peeta, who won the Hunger Games. It's Jennifer Lawrence and Josh Hutcherson. And they have to go on this nationwide victory tour. So they find themselves in all these other districts. They get a sense that there is this revolution happening that's going, aiming to topple this government that does something as barbaric as holding the Hunger Games. They wind it back home for a while, but then they announce the Quarter Quell, which is something that we completely invented and the Hunger Games has ripped off from us. And do not tell Lionsgate's lawyers any differently. Both of them have to go back into the arena because the games will be held with existing victors, which is a pretty... nasty twist. So they go back and they are fighting alongside people like Finnick O'Dare, who is the you know, mid-20s hunky guy played by Sam Claflin, who I have forgiven for all of his boring sins because he's pretty good in this.
Finnick O'Dare?
Finnick O'Dare.
O'Dare.
I literally never heard of this person before this movie.
It reminds me of Chowdare.
You never heard of Sam Claflin or Finnick O'Dare?
Either.
Well, Finnick is a fictional person, so that's fair.
Well, that explains that. Sam Claflin, I'm not so sure, but...
Anyway, so they have to go back into the arena, and then, you know, some things happen from there. So there are some ways in which it's very deliberately repeating, you know, they have Stanley Tucci's back in his blue hair to interview them on television, and they have to go back and prove their skills in the, you know, testing center before it. And they go in the arena, and there's weird creatures that are trying to kill them, and there's other tributes who were, you know, vicious, bloodthirsty killers. But then there
it's
are some,
exactly the fucking it's, same yeah, movie.
It's Harry Potter. It's the same thing as Harry Potter, except for it's hyper accelerated so that the cycle disintegrates at the end of this movie rather than at the end of the sixth movie.
Oh, the exact same thing. Interesting. I didn't think about that, but you're totally right. But what I think makes this movie more interesting is you were saying the stakes are different. So you've got this sense of this revolution happening, which, you know, provides a different context in which they're going into this. And then there are people on the fringes, like Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, Plutarch Heavensby, who is, you know, he's making...
Who is a heroin addict.
Philip Seymour Hoffman looks like he like got dressed 10 minutes before he just showed up and was like, nah, I'm not gonna...
Why is everyone so down on him in this movie? I really liked him.
I think he delivers a really enjoyable performance in his own Philip Seymour Hoffman way, but I think the knowledge that he went into rehab for his heroin addiction right after production certainly clarifies why his character seems sort of somnambulant, but you know, I love Philip Seymour Hoffman and everything, so it's not a dig.
Well, you know, I don't begrudge him this paycheck, and he and Donald Sutherland have all these really fun
as such movies. A Mission Impossible 3 fan, I figured you would have a deep respect for what's going on in this movie with Philip Seymour Hoffman.
This movie is, you know, let's make no bones about it, it's very much improved by having people like Philip Seymour Hoffman, Felix Leiter, or Jeffrey Wright playing Felix Leiter. And it's literally the same voice, the same mannerisms. This is like what Felix does in his off time. And Jenna Malone, who really brings a lot.
It is amazing how much better the movie... I mean, I think the movie is a little better. I'm in the good, not great category on this one, which is a step up from meh. And I think it really is because of the supporting cast who just kind of bring it to life, the other parts of this world. I'm so bored by PETA and Gale. This love triangle that is forced and obnoxious because she shouldn't be with either of these men. They're both terrible boys. I mean, they're just horrible humans.
No, Pete is a good person.
And they mistreat her.
He's just
psychologically.
I think it's a bit generous to say that either of them qualifies as a person. But Gale is sort of a glorified slab of wood.
Yeah, so they both actually started out as the cardboard cutouts you get at party store at the mall, and then they were brought to life.
PETA is certainly better dimensionalized, and I think you sort of root for him on those grounds, but it is my understanding that Gale plays a larger role in you know, future movies. But I think that one of the things that is pronounced in the first third of this movie is the love triangle. It's something, you know, she's faking this love for the cameras with PETA. It's this very broad commentary on our current celebrity culture, as so much of this movie is. And her heart belongs to Gale, I guess, for whatever reason.
Because he's a Hemsworth, and she wants to marry into that blood.
But, like, that's a huge problem because of how strong and independent and bold Katniss can be. Like, why is she stuck in this problem? Yeah. I mean, she doesn't... It doesn't make sense.
In the defense of her, like, I think that she does have some of the problems you guys are saying about the heroine being kind of inert. But she's got this scene with Gale at some point in the woods, and he's like, you know, I don't think he says I love you, but he, like, tries to gets her to say that she loves him. And she was like, I can't think about that. I'm not thinking about anyone that way right now. And she means it. Like, she definitely cares about him. They've been friends for a long time, but she does not care as much about this love triangle as the movie does because it wants to sell tickets. And it's a lot of people around her.
Right. And I think that's a good point and good for her.
Yeah. You know,
like she's also suffering from a pretty severe case of PTSD, having being haunted by the memories that she saw in the barely PG-13 antics of the Hunger Games.
Yeah. Say, what is she suffering from PTSD for? She's hiding in a tree the whole time in the first
exactly.
movie.
We'll get to why the bloodlessness and the timidity of this material really hurts the franchise later. But But yeah, and I think, you know, if the movie wants us to believe that she's suffering from PTSD, then I do, and Jennifer Lawrence pulls it off. I did think, again, one of those first hints that the genre and the audience, the YA genre, is not a good fit for this premise comes when Gail kisses her in the opening 20 minutes of the movie, and you learn that it is their first kiss. And that is just mind-blowing for me because there is it's maybe it's a comment on how we are so much more desensitized to – or it's actually the opposite of that. Sorry. It's the violence is something she sees and processes. She suffers from it. But it's the sex that is like a higher hurdle for her to clear. She's – I just have a lot of trouble believing in how virginal this whole thing is. I think that the, you live in District 12, you got nothing going for you. You're fucking like rabbits all the time. There's if this is going to reflect certain pockets of America and the world, I mean, I think that it's been pretty proven that those areas
they should be inbreeding, right?
Are no, not inbreeding.
I'm joking.
Okay, hang on. I think you're trying to make it too realistic commenting on a certain part of America.
I'm just saying it rubs with the they have this very sober tone to the movie, which I appreciate, which I think befits the circumstances of these characters, but it does not reflect in pivotally human elements such as sexuality. I just did not buy – that was a warning bell for me, a warning sign. I just did not buy at all that it would be so chaste.
They're not really people.
Not interested now, but ever?
Well, they've been like friends and they've been, you know, learning to care about each other that way. I mean, you know, whatever. If it's not in the movies, it's not there. Liam Hemsworth was a block of wood, so I don't blame you for not feeling anything from that relationship.
Yeah. But so, like, so she, it's a corticoil, which, and she goes to the cap. And I think that the, I really had confidence in Francis Lawrence, which is a hard thing to say. Although, again, I did like Water for Elephants.
That's, it's surprising to hear you say that because of everything, well, whatever.
It's not, yeah, but I mean, I think that the first 45 minutes of I Am Legend work too. I think it's when things get bigger that he loses control. But he sets a really nice tone, and the film has a really good handle on not narrative details, but sort of minutia, sort of very small detail. There's a moment in the first film when Prim is walking to the stage, and Gary Ross shows her tucking in her, they cut to behind her, and she tucks in her shirt. And I thought that was a really nice detail.
It's a detail from the book, actually. They specifically mentioned that.
Well, I'm glad that they kept it. I mean, it seemed like a very human moment. And I thought that the first 40 minutes or so of the second one is absolutely replete with that level of detail where it does.
Is there something that stands out to you to that?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of it. I think that Effie – I mean, this is not maybe the sort of nuance I'm talking about, but it is reflected in the storytelling, I think, with Effie, who you realize is also a human, which is something I didn't expect because I thought that she was just sort of a monster. Mm-hmm. And when you see that she has a love for Haymitch and how she sort of has to repress it because of this, you know, horribly tyrannical system, you know, I felt like there was real –
On the detail, I think, and when they go to District 11, which is where the girl Rue, the little girl who got killed in the first one, and they, you know, they accidentally start a riot, and this old man gets killed. I felt like there was really nice detail there in that crowd, and you kind of sense the unrest. And I thought that scene worked really well emotionally, even if you don't really remember that girl dying.
I'm still aching to know more about this world. It's very strange how tunnel vision. This movie, or maybe it's just the narrative, it's the story, because it has to get to the Hunger Games portion of it, the action portion. But I'm like, interested by these different districts. What was that?
I'm asking if you enjoyed the how much of it was spent on the trains, and one of the reasons I did is because I felt like we were learning so much more about this world and being taken, not all around it, but...
Well, I thought maybe there should be more Victory Tour, because... And I think when I walked out of the movie, I was talking to people about how you get when the train comes in to District 11. Is that where Rue died? Mm-hmm. Is that Rue?
Yeah.
You see a group of people picking cotton, and then they come into the city and it's all black people. And I just thought that was like a really interesting comment. Like I didn't get this from the first film that maybe somehow these districts are segregated to like a really despicable degree. And they're doing these fundamental tasks that, you know, people were doing in the 1800s where we've regressed so far that they're segregated. But that doesn't, there's not really a comment on that. Or I just want more of that. And yet this movie is so long. It can't like live and breathe in these moments. It just has to go back to the love story that really doesn't make any sense. Like, PETA is just not interesting enough to keep dwelling on him as a character.
Well, I think, you know, and I think to what Patches was saying, I would have actually liked a greater sort of physical, a sense of the geography of Panem, because they make a big deal about the various districts being sequentially further away from the capital, so that District 12 is really on the outer edges, and that there's sort of like these rings of poverty, and the closer you get to the capital, the better off you are, because District 1 is practically, the people there are like practically almost in the capital.
That is the capital, I think.
Yeah, or whatever, District, yeah, so exactly, and I didn't. The fact that I don't know that, that it was not communicated in the film, I think speaks to how these movies could do a better job of giving a better hierarchy of the whole world spatially, visually, on screen.
Right.
Depending on what they do with – because, you know, they're splitting the final book into two movies, and Lord knows how they're going to fill the time. But I would be really interested. They do travel more around the districts in the third book, and I think there could be
– I hope so, because, I mean, to have such a lengthy film and to go back to scenes I saw in the first one, I mean, even if it's not faithful to book, start setting the action in new places. Like, why am I seeing – the chariot ride into the event again. Like, why am I seeing the training montages?
Because
like, I'm not impressed by this effect anymore.
They had so much more money this time. Compare the chariot ride in this movie to The Hunger Games. It's hilarious.
I know. This is like the Evil Dead 2 of the series. So they're just basically remaking it with more money now that they can do it right.
Basically. Yeah, and thank God that the third book does not involve The Hunger Games at all. Like, they don't go to the arena. So, I mean, and actually, maybe, should we get into spoilers at this point?
Well, no, I don't think we have to get into spoilers quite so soon. But I also think that it starts to break down a little bit when, as the tensions rise in District 12, I think that an actor really took me out of the movie is this guy who plays like the thought police commander.
The new one.
He is not a great actor, unfortunately.
He is a huge cartoon in a movie that has gone so far out of its way and really, really endeavored to have this feeling of veracity in what it's showing and like really make you believe in the hardships of District 12 and the rising tensions between the districts and the capital. And this guy comes in and it is, you know, cartoon Stormtrooper 101.
I don't know. I think he was better than Michael Fassbender in Michael Fassbender's lashing scenes in 12 Years a Slave. No, that is not true.
So Liam Hemsworth for best supporting actor.
To the transition, I think, you know, and I'll let this go to you guys once I say my pieces. My biggest problem, I think I realized with both the Hunger Games films is that, and it goes back to this idea of the premise not being a good fit for the target audience and the genre, is that because they can't really, even though it's like, oh, it's a battle royale, all the drama and the moral crises and whatnot are built around this idea of kids and people in this one, not the kids aren't people, but older people,
no kids are
being forced to kill one another for, you know, not arbitrary reasons, but certainly only to their own advantage because of a very cruel and oppressive system. But the movies can't really let them do that. And so what happens is the games makers contrive these really uninteresting ways to wipe them out, whether in the first one it was horribly rendered CG dogs or tracker jackers, and in this one it's
baboons,
like acid fog and baboons or whatever. It's really sort of undermines everything that the movie is trying to do and establish about the dynamic between these various contestants. It really throws a lot of needless and slack wrinkles into how the characters interact with one another. What's their dynamic with one another? How much do they really want to kill each other? Do I believe it? Not necessarily.
Right.
And the really problematic part for me and why I think it really fails and betrays the whole film's world altogether is that it's not just that I find it uninteresting, and I certainly do, but I believe strongly that the in-world viewers of The Hunger Games, the residents of the capital, would find it, you know, incredibly disappointing and in no way sating their own appetites for blood.
We should start a podcast that reviews Hunger Games.
So that's my big problem.
Yeah, can you imagine watching them sleep at night and like run away from fog in the dark? Perfect.
I mean, I think about this stuff when I watch it. I think about it in relation to something like The Truman Show and whatnot. And I just think that this the movie doesn't make it a sustainable, you know, believable and comprehensibly well or coherently well thought out world at all. And that's why I think both movies really suffer enormously once you get to the Hunger Games.
Well, it's nice to feel the audience from the outside. You get a little bit of it in the first Hunger Games, not really any in the Catching Fire, because you get maybe like one gift that pops up from Haymitch. So no one's contributing to this game anymore from the outside. And that's why I think there's no tension within the Hunger Games. You know, the scariest parts of this movie, and there's some genuinely terrifying moments, I think, for me, like seeing a guy in a district get shot in the head, you know, like I was kind of startled by that because I was not expecting that level of violence. And from the government people, like just shooting random strangers to make a point. That's scary.
What I want to say, but are you down? Sorry, I don't want to.
Well, I was also going to say, well, now I've lost my train of thought, so I have no idea what the other scary moment that I was talking about is.
I just had one other thing to add about the actual structure of the games this time before we start with spoilers.
Wait, give me one second. Right, I remember the other scary thing. The other scary thing is when they learn that they have to go back to the Hunger Games. Like, that moment is just, it sucked the life out of me. Like, I felt my gut wrench when, you know, you're watching Jennifer Lawrence and she learns that she has to go back to the Hunger Games. She just loses her shit. And so does everyone else. And I mean, it's just so scary. The feeling that you have to go to a death match ends up being scarier in this movie than actually being in the death match.
Right. I completely agree. But did anyone else struggle with the idea that the whole idea and the premise of the Hunger Games would be defanged by having to bring back previous contestants? Like, the whole idea is that it keeps the districts in check. And if they violate the contract with the districts by saying that, oh, even these people that killed all their other tributes and survived and have a lifetime of peace have to come back, it's sort of this all rules are off thing. And the districts, and I guess you do see the revolution, and so maybe.
And the whole idea is to remind them how powerful the capital is, and that, you know, they can change the rules like that.
It's hard to really, you know, it would be hard to imagine that the districts would subscribe to this plan if the rules were changed at a whim like that. But at the same time, maybe the movie eventually shows me up in how things play out. So,
All right. So the thing I wanted to say about the arena before we get into spoilers is what I like about this one as compared to the first one is that you've got all these senses of alliances going on from the very beginning. In the first movie, you've got Katniss by herself forever, all the hiding in a tree like you were talking about. In this one, she is trying to trust first Finnick and then Johanna, the character played by Jenna Malone, and you don't really know if these people are worth trusting. And, you know, having read the book, I knew how it turned out, but I thought there was a genuine sense of tension in her not knowing what the deal with these characters was, and then Katniss going against her inherent desire to strike off on her own and having to work with these people, and that gives it a totally different personal dynamic as opposed to, you know, when you get the baboons and the...
Yeah, the movie shows its hand too early. I mean, I am not really one of those viewers who likes to sit in a film and try to get ahead of it and think, what's going to come next? What's the plot twist going to be? But it really reveals what's going after, I think, a little bit too early. And so you're just waiting for the theory that sort of incepted into your head.
But luckily, everyone involved is fun. You know, it's kind of Ocean's 11-y, all these different wacky characters. I mean, Jenna Malone is a hoot in this movie. Her stripping scene is like crazy funny. And the look on Jennifer Lawrence's face as Jenna Malone strips in front of her is gold. That is comedy gold. Really, it's amazing. It's really, and like you said, Jeffrey Wright is perfect. I mean, he's just this brainiac, but he brings such life to it. And even like Lynn Cohen, who doesn't say anything, just watching her ride on Sam Claflin's back, I was enjoying that visual.
I never really understood the relationship. I may have missed like a line of
she,
dialogue.
She took the spot of someone that Sam Claflin really cares about. The person that he was kind of pronouncing his love to during the interview.
Right, right. Okay. Now, was anyone else, when it got to the arena itself, sort of suffering from their own PTSD, but of the Lost variety?
I thought the same thing. Well, maybe I associate Hawaii so closely now to Lost.
Or Hawaii.
I'm just like, where are the others?
As they're on the beaches figuring out the various alliances, and then as you learn the literal twist of this particular arena, it's hard not to think of Lost.
Okay, let's use this opportunity to go into spoilers.
Jennifer Lawrence, you're a very good actor, lady. You're in the Hunger Games and you do a very good job in it. Jennifer Lawrence, you are the new Hollywood it girl. Everybody wants to kiss you in the whole wide world. Jennifer Lawrence, you're such a fine actress, lady. Everybody loves to watch you act in movies. Jennifer Lawrence, you make a whole lot of money. What do you do with all that money? You can do whatever you want, Jennifer Lawrence. Everybody thinks you're wonderful. All the teenage girls in the world wanna kill all the teenagers in a fight to the death in a Hunger Games scenario. Jennifer Lawrence, you were in Winter's Bone. It's a very bleak movie, and you do a very good job in it, Jennifer Lawrence. You're a pretty actress girl. All the boys in the world want to kiss your mouth. Yes, they do, Jennifer Lawrence.
What I have to say about The Last Shot is not in any way related to the plot. I think that now we've seen with Twilight 4 Part 1, Avatar, this film, probably a few others that I'm forgetting.
Oh, no, there was another one really recently, and I can't think of what it was. I think maybe it was Twilight. I'm thinking.
These movies that exist to be a segueing chapter in a longer saga are starting to all end with shots where the characters look into the camera and sort of announce silently with their eyes their intentions to fight back, to their conviction is there. And the version of this shot is the worst moment I think Jennifer Lawrence has ever had on screen as far as her acting goes. She has to go through such a range of emotions in this one shot, and it feels like an acting exercise. They're like, be mad.
Piercing smirk. Piercing smirk.
I was giggling. It's really, although, you know, silently, because I'm not a disruptive moviegoer in that way. But I'm chortling in the movie, except for that one time, whatever it was, when I was sighing. But the Jeff Wells sigh. But yeah, I think that this is a trend that needs to be nipped in the bud. Anyone?
Yeah, it's. The book ends basically the exact same way, with probably more over-explanatory dialogue, and you're ready to get out of there at that point. There's no good. What's weird, and this is maybe a segment three someday, is how movies ending a movie on a cliffhanger is just really like people really reject it these days, and I think a lot of people are rejecting this moment too, even though they really had no choice.
I mean, they did have a choice because you don't have to just straight up adapt the book. I mean, it's clunky; it doesn't have a climax. I mean, this is not a fun ending.
Yeah, it's true, and I knew because the movie was already 2.5 hours long that we were probably close to the end. Certainly the big scene right before that doesn't feel like the climax of a movie this long, but which is a problem. But I think even within that scene, when there are certain lines, if we're not doing this as a spoiler section, because I still don't think we need to.
No, we are. We're doing it as a spoiler section.
Well, when they're like, you know, you are the Mockingjay, or like, this is the revolution, like hard cut to black, like that would have been exciting. But sure. I think it's really, and this, it seems like nitpicking, but this, it just seems
it does,
sort of
it's
endemic.
It's weird to leave a movie that you like and then with the weird taste in your mouth because the ending is kind of weird.
And this last shot, which is, you've seen done now 3 times, is just a really strange trend.
I don't understand not having a major conflict to end this movie. Like, isn't there some way they could have thrown a couple goons who come after them as they're preparing to do this?
What I enjoyed about reading the book and reading these scenes is that ending does come in a surprise. You know, you realize you've got 4 pages left or something. You're like, what the hell? How is this going to end? And then this huge, crazy thing happens that you weren't expecting and she wasn't expecting. And I liked that element of surprise in the book, but I get that movies work.
But the movie doesn't.
Really, the only surprise is that Philip Seymour Hoffman's in on it, right? Because, like, the rest you pretty much know. Like, you know that they're all...
Did you know that she was going to, like, break the... Like, destroy the arena and, you know, get everybody out of there? But not everybody?
I mean, I don't really care about what happens to the other people. I like them as characters, some of them. But, like, you know, it doesn't really matter to me if she breaks them out or not. But you know that they're all sacrificing themselves in some way or somehow rigging the game to her advantage. You know that. And so, really, when she gets there... I guess it's just a matter of who are the ringleaders here. And learning that Philip Seymour Hoffman is involved in that is kind of like an it also made me really wish that we had met him in the first movie so that it had been built up a little bit more. But
right. Yeah. As long as Sam Claflin lives, I like that guy.
I like him too. I never would have guessed that
and
I would say that.
Yeah, you know, Jenna Malone, then I understand you don't have to reveal anything about the next few movies, but they make mention of her at the end that she has been kidnapped and is in the capital.
PETA.
So you know that she's gonna be back, and that bodes well. But it does sound like the first I mean, I've heard that this is the high point of the series from the people who read the books, and it sounds like the first Mockingjay film is really going to be like Harry, the Deathly Hallows Part One, yeah, to the nth degree.
Yeah, there's a lot of potential if they're willing to dramatize stuff that's only mentioned offhand in the books, which is a huge problem with the last book. But every time I think that a really popular series is going to take more liberties with adaptations, they never do. So I'm trying not to get my hopes up.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I'll watch whatever they throw at it, because I liked Francis Lawrence doing his thing here. The IMAX footage. David, did you, or Katie, did you guys see it in IMAX?
I saw it in IMAX.
That's not like, cool.
And the problem was that I understand, you know, from interviews with Lawrence, Francis Lawrence, that when she rides the human-sized pneumatic tube up to the arena,
yes,
it suddenly cuts to wide, and I imagine that's pretty cool, but...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It doesn't cut to wide. It segues. It opens up. So she travels through a dark tube, and it kind of like opens up with her very seamlessly. It's amazing.
A couple of Batman movies did that. That effect is really...
And then it's the whole Hunger Games sequences in IMAX.
Really?
Batman had hard cuts.
Expanse in...
Yeah, Batman had too much of back and forth to really be able to seamlessly do it.
And it's the same thing with Ghost Protocol, which like it cues you for these action beats, and so I think that just concentrating it in one element is probably better. But no, my screen was just giant the entire time.
I must say that it looks stunning. Like, there's a clear difference between the footage, as there always will be, because it's pristine film and then crap digital HD 4K, whatever they're shooting the other portions on. But it's just amazing how much visual information you get from an IMAX frame. I'll always want to see these movies that are actually shot IMAX on IMAX. It's so much more fulfilling.
Hunger Games not in 3D, but on IMAX. It's actually...
And I couldn't believe that
letting
the whole...
Letting you use your money well.
Yeah, I couldn't believe that the whole Hunger Games sequence was actually in IMAX. You can see the fog the way it was meant to be seen.
And the baboons. And Sam Claflin's pecs. Actually, I guess he's wearing that.
Also... I'm going to continue my very end of the movie nitpicking, and this is a much bigger nitpick, or a smaller nitpick, rather. I mean, it's, like, dumber than my previous complaint about the last shot, is there's, like, a 90 seconds. It feels like 90 seconds. I'm sure it's only, like, 30. Like, CG Mockingjay pin thing that happens after the movie ends. You guys remember what I'm talking
about? Yeah, is that, like, get ready for Mockingjay now that I've transformed?
It's, like, a little too long, and it becomes very, very silly very quickly. And I was just like, that felt like fan service. And when you're middling on the movie, it's just, like, it's just smacking you in the face.
I think that does it for our review of Catching Fire, which we actually think that we should go see, that you should all go see, which was not necessarily, well, you know, you're probably going to go see it anyway, so don't let David.
Much, much better than the first one, for sure.
Fair enough. You can find this podcast at fightinginthewarroom.com, on Twitter at FITWR, and on Facebook at facebook.com/fightinginthewarroom. We're working on the shorter version of that. It is stupidly complicated for reasons that have just to do with Facebook bureaucracy. For the rest of you guys, where can people find you guys?
Yes, I am Matt Patches. I am on the internet, writing all over the place and putting it all on mattpatches.com, and I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. And please, please, please tell people about the new name and the new podcast. Woo!
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior editor of film.com. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich and at film, DOTCOM. And yes, to echo what Patches said, please spread the word about Fitwer podcast.
Fitwer.
On Twitter, what are we? We're at FITWR.
Yep. And I am Katie Rich. You can find me starting December 2nd at Vanity Fair's Hollywood section online. But before then, and for now and all time, you can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. Thank you for listening. Thank you for helping us inaugurate Fighting in the War Room. And we'll be back talking to you next week.
Everybody wants to rule the world. Fade it, fade it. the world.